I'm Frank Vaughn. It is May 8th, 2025, and this is the Fulcrum. And there's so many things to talk about that slipping in importance is Mark Carney's visit down to the South, which has been commentated on by everybody ad nauseum. So maybe we'll talk about that at the end of the video. I think what we need to talk about right now is actually India and Pakistan, the one thing that nobody seems to want to parse or talk about. Maybe people just don't understand this civilizational conflict and what it means for the world if it actually spirals out of control, which is what it's doing right now. When you have dozens of people dying by the day on either side and dozens of videos coming out showing the bombing damage and showing the strikes as they're happening, you're in a period of escalation. So we need to go over this and what it means for the world, because this is a local conflict that has global implication. The first thing that you need to understand about India and Pakistan is that they're nuclear armed, but this isn't the same as Western or Russian or Chinese nuclear arms. Most of their nuclear forces are fission or fission boosted weapons. They don't have thermonuclear weapons. Both nations conducted nuclear tests in 1998, and they claim to have detonated thermonuclear bombs. But experts in the rest of the world who have been building nuclear weapons, thermonuclear weapons, for a lot longer, cast shade on that. So even if in the last 27 years they've managed to perfect thermonuclear weapons without an abundance of testing, the majority of their forces are going to be fission or fission boosted, which means they're far dirtier. They produce a lot more longer lasting radiation and consequences, in particular when they hit cities and military targets that create a lot of dust and a lot of fallout. Now, there's a lot of factors, wind and circumstances during a nuclear exchange, but the fact is we're talking about long-term pollution of the land around the areas that are nuked. Now, India, may come as a surprise to you, is a large exporter of food. They're one of the biggest exporters of rice. There are large exports of fish and other food products to the world. You can anticipate in a limited nuclear exchange that those markets would break down at a minimum, and that their food products from that polluted land would not be wanted by the rest of the world. Or if the world was in such a dire situation that those food products were needed anyway, those food products would not be that good for those consuming them. What I'm trying to say is, a nuclear war isn't just about the death that occurs at the outset. It's about the long-term lasting consequences. Now, you might say, who would be foolish enough to use nuclear weapons? Or you might say, as some people do, that nuclear weapons are fake news, that they don't work, that in spite of all of the historical evidence, it's all fake, and it was CGI in the 1950s when they were blowing these things up. Nuclear weapons work, folks. It's one of the only reasons we occupy one of the most peaceful periods in human history. Believe it or not, with all the conflict that's raged since World War II, we're actually living in a very peaceful bubble relative to the rest of the human experience. Now, you have to understand there's something called nuclear doctrine as well. Pakistan has a specific first use policy. Why do they have a first use policy? And by the way, that just means, if it's not abundantly clear, they reserve the right to use nuclear weapons first. Instead of being anti-first use, they say they will do first use, and that's because their nuclear forces are built primarily to deal with India. India has 1.4 billion people. Pakistan has about 247 million people. They lose a kinetic war with India fairly quickly if India goes full tilt invading Pakistan, which is why they hold a first use doctrine. Before we go back to Google Earth and have a zoom in and look at these two nations, I've seen very little commentary, but I have seen mainstream media suggest the situation's under control and things are not spiraling out of control. However, this is just 2 days on this map of attacks and attempted attacks all along the India-Pakistan border. This is a pretty wide-ranging crisis. It is definitely in an escalating phase because deaths are moving up rather quickly, and we're getting new headlines of new attacks almost hourly. So the situation is, to say the least, very fluid. I've often thought of this conflict in the area of the world as the other Israel-Palestine, because it is a Gordian knot. the two sides have virtually incompatible views over Jammu and Kashmir, which is where this conflict centers. Both sides claim it in its entirety. And what's at stake here, particularly for Pakistan, but also India, is a whole lot of water. All the tributaries that feed into the mighty Indus River, which is the lifeblood of Pakistan, emanate from Kashmir. And I need you to understand, this is the Indus, the mighty Indus, which sustains all of this. Now, I'm just looking at the video as I'm recording it. Look at how thickly populated. It's not just these big cities that line its banks, but it's all these densely packed little villages. I mean, I don't know what you call it. Despair. When I look at this, I feel despair because there's no nature left. They're all numbered. Chak 288, Chak 276, Chak 275. I've spent a lot of time looking at Pakistan from the air. It is packed. It's very different from when Alexander came a conquering through the area. Very full and very religiously cohesive. So Pakistan is 96% Muslim. We're talking about the mix of fundamentalist religious beliefs and nuclear arms, belief in the afterlife, belief in paradise, belief in some form of manifest destiny, I guess you could say. People who are willing to die over Kashmir. The partition hasn't solved their problems. And at the same time, New Delhi, which is the capital of India, which is right here, not too far from the Pakistan border, they face another issue. Islam is growing in India, rising from 9% to 17%. So almost one in five Indians are now Muslim, whereas in Pakistan, every other religious faith is fading and Islam is taking over. And for the purpose of this video, we're not judging, but we need to talk about fundamentalism. We need to talk about reality. We need to talk about how unwilling Pakistan is going to be to give up the very headwaters of the lifeblood that enables, look at the way the country's laid out. Everything is the Indus. I also want to show you briefly, we talk about climate change a lot. We talk about cutting carbon emissions in the West and how we got to save the world. I want to show you what climate change really looks like. And climate change isn't the result of CO2. It's the result of overpopulation in certain parts of the world. And we don't talk about that. We just talk about, I remember one time, I was at the farmer's market, and it was right around the time I had found out that my wife was pregnant with our second. And it's a complex story. We don't need to get into the weeds. But I announced we had this second baby coming, and I remember I was talking to an NDPer, and they said, so I guess you're done now. And I said, I don't know if we're done. Maybe we'll have a third one. And they were horrified. They're like, do you think of the carbon footprint of that child that you're going to bring into the world? It is not Western babies, with all the room that we have in our nations, with all the natural resources that we've managed and kept clean, because, by the way, the Indus River is one of the most polluted rivers in the entire world, whereas the rivers and lakes in North America, for instance, or in Europe, are incredibly clean by comparison, but I digress. This is what climate change actually looks like. These are all places that they've tried to farm, they've tried to settle, and they have failed. And you can go all up and down these areas, and you can see where the desert is taking back over because they've stretched too far. The population pressure is so immense. And I mean, it's the whole thing. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of kilometers of attempts to bring completely unviable desert into production and then failure. Nowhere can you find jungle. Nowhere can you find nature. It is just full. Pakistan is completely full. So what is the point to somebody living in Canada or the United States if it's not already obvious? It's that, number one, we bring a large number of immigrants from these places, and they bring their old ethnic conflicts with them. They don't leave their culture at the door. They bring it with them. And in Canada, at the very least, We encourage the celebration and establishment of their culture, not just in our societies, but also in our politics. So these conflicts come home with them. And this conflict, it's not just geopolitical in nature between the two nations. It's also very religious. Kashmir is sacred to the Muslims. Kashmir is sacred to the Hindus. It's also sacred to Sikhs. It's very hard. It's hard to see a political resolution to something so incompatible. And markets and people seldom take seriously the very real threat of nuclear war, because nuclear war is so unthinkable, we all just assume that it can never happen. But it'll come like a thief in the night if it does come, because it'll be a decision that's made, and within 5 or 10 minutes, it will be irreversible. It's something that can happen so quick. So what can you do? Build resilience. It's the same kind of things I advised pre-COVID, before the hysteria hit. Just make sure you're resilient. Luckily, this is a long ways away, so direct fallout risk isn't as big a threat, radioactive risk. It's the disruption of markets. It's the disruption of the food supply. It's the cascading effects. If it was a wide-ranging nuclear war, like a full-scale nuclear exchange, there's going to be global dimming and cooling that goes on. Bill Gates won't have to worry about geoengineering the world, because nuclear war will geoengineer it for him. And we'll all discover that cold actually sucks and warm's actually pretty good, and we shouldn't have been fighting warm this entire time, even if it were to happen, because all of our lives depend on the interglacial warm period that we live in right now. One other thing, while we have Google Earth opened, I just want to show you, because we're always talking about the impact of humans and reduction of footprint, and how Canada, with its 40 million people and its impossibly high immigration targets, which, if people are the real enemy of civilization, if people are the real enemy of the earth, if it's our CO2 output and footprint that's actually threatening the entire planet, why are we doing high immigration? It doesn't make any sense. Canada is also is already a very sustainable country with our low population. We should probably be seeking to keep our population low and not grow it, if that was our concern. That's how you know it's all BS. And since we have Google Earth open, I want to show you ecological change on a scale that almost defies the human imagination. Now, here's Earth. This region is what we're going to focus on. And as we zoom in, we're going to see the same effect that we've seen in Pakistan. The cities become clear, and as you zoom in, you see all this almost sandy-looking features. Every single one of them is a packed town or city, whatever you want to call it. Everywhere. There's no nature. It's all been tamed. All of this depends on the interglacial warm period that we live in to sustain all of this life. If these people start starving, you have massive civil unrest. This is China. It goes on and on and on and on. There's no end to it in sight. Canada does not look like this. We are not the problem. We should be maintaining a lower population, not trying to increase it. Now, look at this gray section here. I just want to zoom in on this, too. So you zoom in and you think this is just another typical city, and it's not. These are all greenhouses, folks. Unfathomable amounts of greenhouse. Look at it. And our leaders want to lecture us about the problem that Canada represents? That somehow Canada alone, by leading the way, is going to save the planet? We're not the problem. Now, this admittedly cursory examination, not just of geopolitical flashpoints, but also flashpoints in genuine climate change and ecological catastrophe, focusing on the actual issue. I think the reason why guys like Mark Carney write books like Values, where he talks about net zero and he talks about all these highfalutin plans, is because if we focus on the Sky Dragon, the myth of CO2 being the primary pollutant that is driving global degradation, we don't have to focus on real problems that are next to impossible to solve, like the ones I've just shown you. The overpopulation problem in China is impossible to solve without time or conflict. The same with India and Pakistan. That conflict, that overpopulation, that pressure, that ecological damage that they're doing every single day is next to impossible to solve from the perspective of the West, to the point that we don't even try. We just talk about net zero, this fantasy. So is it any wonder that we can, because we're so consumed with these fantastical ideas, solutions and to problems that are non-existent, all-consuming, because so many people are focused on climate change, so many people believe that every single thunderstorm is a sign that we have irreparably damaged the world. And meanwhile, the Indus River just pukes plastic pollution into the ocean. Every single river in India is polluted almost beyond repair. The land is completely overwhelmed by population pressure. While we sit here in our beautiful societies that we've created, because they are beautiful, they're the best the world has ever done. They're clean, or at least they were. They're largely pristine by comparison. And we cast shade on ourselves. We engage in this self-hatred when we should be engaged in civilizational pride. We should be trying to protect all that we have done. Instead, we are throwing it away to the world that has destroyed itself through mass immigration and importation of culture and ethnic values and norms that are incompatible with the very goals that guys like Mark Carney espouses in his book. But anyway, let's look at this.
The old relationship we had with the United States, based on deepening integration of our economies and tight security and military cooperation, is over.
I want you to note something, too, that I noted when he made this statement. He nods like this. He is talking about something being done. If his body language was ringing with what he was saying, he would have shook his head no, but instead, it's a firm nod. That's a telling body
language. Thank you for your hospitality and above all for your leadership. You're a transformational president, focus on the economy with a relentless focus on the American worker, securing your borders, ending the scourge of fentanyl and other opioids, and securing the world.
Imagine a liberal leader. Imagine Justin Trudeau talking about secure borders only a year ago. Imagine during the election campaign. Actually, I know what would happen. If Mark Carney had have made such positive, ringing statements about President Trump during the election campaign, the media would have just spun it to be something that it wasn't. Now, Polyev couldn't have said any of these things without being faced with intense criticism. Remember, people, the psychological warfare that you underwent, labeling Polyev as the willing partner to Donald Trump, the guy who would bring MAGA to Canada. And Carney goes down there. And in spite of everything that we're seeing from the media, the punditry, the leftist premiers, including Doug Ford, celebrating Carney's victorious visit to Washington, for all intents and purposes, he bent the knee. And if not bending the knee, Canada's pain and suffering, as we've talked about in my videos, will be most intense. Because as Trump says, rightly, America doesn't need what Canada has. America is a willing partner. They can be partners with someone else. And as much as Carney and his ilk present this case that just getting our stuff to Tidewater is enough to secure our future, those markets are oceans away. They're very fluid. It doesn't make sense to not engage the United States, which is why I think at the end of the day, all the people who voted for the Liberal Party and voted for the fight, remember elbows up? Elbows up is gone. You're probably never going to hear that term again. Because now we're in the post-election world. The electorate has been successfully duped. They have delivered a mandate. The psychological operation was successful. And it doesn't matter what Carney does, because the media will spin it as a net positive, even if it completely contradicts everything he said on the campaign trail, even if it completely contradicts everything they said and did to defeat Polyev, even if Carney engages with Trump in exactly the way you were told to fear Polyev engaging with Trump. A couple more things I want to briefly touch on today. Carla Beck, a referendum on separation from Canada will drive jobs and investments out of Saskatchewan, even if it's unsuccessful. Just look at what happened to Quebec. I heard that loud and clear in my meeting with energy leaders this week. That's why today I introduced Bill 604 to Keep Saskatchewan in Canada Act. I just want to know, who is Carla Beck working for? Is she working in the interests of the province that elected her? Is she working in the interests of Canada? If she wants to work in the interests of Canada, she's in the wrong branch of government. She should resign now as leader of the NDP in Saskatchewan and run for federal leader of the rump NDP that Jagmeet Singh has left behind. What is she doing? Why is she so against a democratic conversation? She highlights Quebec. Quebec keeps their resources in the ground so that they can engage Canada for welfare checks in the form of equalization. Why isn't Carla mad about that? Why isn't she upset about the constitutional unfairness that keeps Western Canada down? Instead, she is concerned that her subjects, even though she's in opposition, she's not even in government yet, might actually use their voices to indicate and lodge their concerns successfully. Because Quebec, in spite of her spin here, has been highly successful in engaging their provincial autonomy. As we've said before in my work, the Bloc Québécois and the Parti Québécois are proof of that. Quebec does very well by being autonomous. This is jumping the shark. The Federation is punitive towards the West. And everybody has an interest, not just people in energy and gas, but almost everybody, even those who are subject to the Indian Act, should lodge their complaints now. We have a moment in time, a stitch in time, where we can actually positively impact change through our premiers. And luckily, Carla Beck's not our premier. Scott Moe's our premier. Hopefully, he's looking to Daniel Smith's example, because if you watched the last video I put out, Daniel Smith released a list of demands that's going to be impossible for Carney's Ottawa to meet. It's too comprehensive. An end to equalization, guaranteed access to Tidewater, which the federal government has opposed this entire time. Just to name two, I think we are in new times. Don't let the Carla Becks of the world discourage you. Now is the time to find your voice. Now is the time to lodge your complaints. Now is the time to write your MLA. Why not push for more sovereignty? What's the downside? That's what I would ask Carla. What is the downside of a push towards autonomy? The provinces have only to gain, because Ottawa's contribution to Western Canada has been repression, and it's been that way for 150 years. Also, does she just not know how to negotiate? The voice of Western Canada, those who are crying out for sovereignty, they're actually strengthening your hand, or strengthening our leaders' hands, in negotiating with Ottawa. You can go to Ottawa and say, look at all the noise the people are making. You need to make change, or we're going to have a crisis. Why is Carla getting in the way of strengthening Saskatchewan's hand in negotiations? She's literally torpedoing the province that elected her. This is the art of the deal. Now, I know that Carla's not going to be reading Trump, but you don't need to read Trump's book to understand how negotiation tactics work. Now is the time to make noise. Even if you want to stay in the Federation, you should be making sovereign noises, because it only leads to a stronger hand. I'm repeating myself at this point. I can't even believe how bad her public position is, and how early she's taken such a strong stance that doesn't make any sense if she was actually working to the benefit of the people who elected her. Go run in federal politics, Carla. Jeez. Leave negotiations for those who can actually understand what we're doing here. This is the last thing today. The responsible lie, how AI sells conviction without truth. And I'm just going to read the first couple paragraphs. The widespread excitement around generative AI, particularly large language models like ChatGPT, Gemini, Grok, and DeepSeek, is built on a fundamental misunderstanding. While these systems impress users with articulate responses and seemingly reasoned arguments, the truth is that what appears to be reasoning is nothing more than a sophisticated form of mimicry. These models aren't searching for truth through facts and logical arguments. They're predicting text based on patterns in the vast data sets they're trained on. That's not intelligence, and it isn't reasoning. And if their training data is itself biased, then we've got real problems. I keep talking about this point, and this is a two-pronged point that I'm trying to make here. The first point is, AI is not a replacement for reason. It's not a replacement for you. It's a tool, much like Google search. And what you tell it and how you talk to it will dictate how it responds to you. I mean, do some experimentation. Approach AI from one juxtaposed argument and then build a conversation with it, strengthening and strengthening and strengthening that point that you initially start with. And then start to talk about the other point. And it will build an argument just as strong for the other side of the argument. It will do whatever you want it to, which is why it sickens me when I see people posting screenshots of Grok as though that is truth. Grok is a tool. You need to verify it. You need to engage reason. Now, further to this AI situation that we're in right now, I honestly think that influencers, people like myself, should commit to not using altered video because it's going to get impossible. It's almost impossible now. I can still spot it. It's going to become impossible soon to discern real from fake. And we need people to make a solid commitment to only share what is real. Because I seen a video. It's Mark Carney delivering a talk in some, I think it was some BBC forum. And there's people making a claim that that video has been purged from the internet. I'm relatively convinced that that video is AI. And what it does is it quotes from his book, which I think in one of the parts of my multi-part series reviewing his book, I think I've actually highlighted the specific quote that's used in the generation of that video. So the quote is real, but the video footage in the forum are not real. And instead of owning that they're not real, people are claiming it's been purged from the internet. This is a slippery slope, and we should all commit to not engaging with it. Not only not creating artificially generated video content that is made to look serious, but also not sharing it and not promoting the people who generate that content. I'm not judging anybody that shared it. I'm judging the people who create it. We need to make a firm commitment to not engage this way, or we're going to lose sight of reality. And maybe it's inevitable. Maybe this is like an avalanche and there's nothing you can do to stop it. And the only thing that you're going to know is real anymore is what's right in front of your face. The small communities that you occupy, which this is a scary thing. If you don't know what is real in the world, you need to rely on your community to anchor yourself in reality for grounding. But in the age of social media and in the post-COVID age, communities have been irreparably broken. So those physical personal ties are not as strong in most places. Now, where I live, it's a little different. The people still get together. People still do dinners. People still engage with one another. People still go to community groups and churches and do all this wonderful stuff that anchors them in reality. But if you don't have that, it's going to be quite a challenge to try and discern what is real from what is fake. Anyway, I genuinely believe that if you're serious about trying to help the world, if you're not just here engaging for clicks and likes and shares and getting dopamine hits constantly by how much life you rob from people with your content, then you should make a commitment to avoid artificial AI any fake videos. And I think you should make that commitment today. I'm Frank Vaughn. I'll see you in the next one.